This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today my guest is Dr. C.L. Bragg, better known as Chip Bragg, a longtime friend and the author of a new book, Martyr of the American Revolution, The Execution of Isaac Hayne, South Carolinian. Chip, welcome back to the Journal.
Thank you very much.
You're a physician by training, but you've had a long time interest in history. And this is what, the third or fourth book you've written?
Fourth book, yes,
fourth
sir.
Book. Well, let's start off. Who is Isaac Hayne?
Isaac Hayne was a South Carolina patriot. He was a member of the Lowcountry planter aristocracy. He resided in Collington County. What was called Pon Pon at the time is now Jacksonboro. And he was caught up in a set of circumstances during the war that were not entirely of his own creation and became a casualty of the war very late and was unique in that the death of a patriot during a war is not an especially uncommon thing, but the circumstances surrounding Isaac Hayne's capture and death makes his story, at least to me, very poignant because he was a young father, a widower, and he was executed by the British in August 1781 despite the pleadings of his children and his family and his friends and even many loyalists.
As you said, the death of patriots in the American Revolution is a story that's been told many times, many places, and many individuals. And in South Carolina, the British were particularly brutal about stringing people up at the drop of the hat if they had switched sides. But a lot of that happened on the frontier or in outposts like Camden and 96. It didn't happen in Charleston, which was occupied by the British. And it might help if we give our listeners a little bit of a background going from the fall of Charleston forward, because that's instrumental, kind of key to this whole story.
Well, the American Army surrendered to the British on May 12, 1780, the American Army in Charleston under Major General Benjamin Lincoln. And this was probably the greatest American defeat of the Revolutionary War. The surrender occurred under an agreement, the Articles of Capitulation, that specified that certain groups of people would be treated in certain ways. The Continental soldiers would be treated a certain way. The militia who were in town would be treated a certain way. And then the civilians would be treated a certain way. And the idea was that the militiamen who had been serving in Charleston would be allowed to go home on parole, and as long as they behaved themselves, they would generally be left alone.
All right, let's stop and explain what parole was in the 18th century.
Parole in the context of 18th and 19th century warfare was a device, so to speak, that allowed armies who captured large numbers of prisoners to be able to deal with those prisoners in a humane way. So in our case, say, for example, the British had over 5,000 prisoners when they captured Charleston. Well, there's no way that they could house, feed, and tend to that many prisoners. So under the conditions of a parole, which was a signed statement, the prisoners were allowed a degree of freedom, and they were honor-bound by this latitude that they were given not to act in any way against their captors.
And it actually was a piece of paper they had. They kind of had to keep with them that they had taken parole.
Yes.
So they were supposed to go back home, tend their fields, what have you. In the case, Isaac Hayne was to go back to his plantation at Pon Pon.
Isaac Hayne was not captured in Charleston, but it was generally assumed by the militia who were in the field outside of Charleston that the conditions of parole that were given to the militiamen in town would apply to them also. And he went home like that.
So he went home without a piece of paper.
Right.
Because there were other posts in South Carolina that surrendered after Charleston, 96, Camden, Georgetown. And I guess those guys didn't get paroles either. Or they thought they were paroled, but they didn't get the paper.
Well, it became a moot point.
Okay.
Because the British commanding officer who had captured Charleston, Major General Sir Henry Clinton, maybe he was a lieutenant general by then, before he left Charleston to go back to New York, leaving South Carolina in the hands of Cornwallis, he issued a handbill and a set of three proclamations that, in essence, changed the rules for everybody.
So it made no difference if you had the piece of paper. He tore it up. Now, one thing I really like about your book, you have a number of appendices, and you include these key documents, the terms of capitulation, the issuance of parole, and then the revocation of the handbill, revoking it, which people talk about, but you get to see and understand the language of it. Now, Clinton's revocation of the parole, he basically said, you either are going to have to take our side, which means to take up arms against your countrymen, or you're a rebel. That's pretty much what he's saying, right?
That is. And I included the actual handbill and proclamations in the appendix because in discussing these in the narrative, I wanted the reader to be able to look back and refer to what Henry Clinton actually said rather than just being dependent on my own interpretation of what he was saying. And in my simplistic way of thinking, there was a handbill and three proclamations, but I tend to look at these as one act. And in his repeated proclamations, he was trying to add clarity to what he had said before. But you pretty much summed it up in that he did away with paroles. He said, no more paroles. You're either on our side and you'll have the rights and privileges of a British subject, and you may be asked to support the army or serve in the provincial army, or else we're going to treat you harshly as an enemy. And the effect that had was these men who had gone home believing that they were just going to sit out the rest of the war and wait to see what happened, they were thrust into the uncomfortable position of making a decision that they really didn't want to make.
All right. I want to back up a minute when we talk about the prisoners that were captured at Charleston, 5,000. Mm-hmm. How many of those were Continentals?
Just off the top of my head, I'm not sure I can tell you, but I want to say maybe 2,500.
So about half of them were Continentals. The other half were militiamen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And as you mentioned, that did not include the militiamen who were at the outposts away from Charleston. So you can understand the British, what are we going to do with all of these? What did they do with the Continentals?
Well, they housed the enlisted men in barracks that were downtown fairly close to what we now call Marion Square. And the officers they sent over to Hadrill's Point, which is near present-day Mount Pleasant.
Very near Charles Pinckney's plantation.
Yeah. In fact, General, or at the time Colonel Moultrie, and Charles Cotesworth Pinckney actually resided out there on Snee Farm.
I have got the document here, and I'm just going to read a couple of passages because from a military historian's point of view, Cornwallis and Clinton particularly did everything wrong. They had captured the greatest city of British North America. Sorry, Boston, New York, the richest city. The jewel of the empire, as they said, in London. And then they threw it away through arrogance, stupidity. Yeah, I guess you can use all sorts of words. But this is the first proclamation right after the fall of Charleston, and it's issued by Sir Henry Clinton. And people need to understand that we always refer to Cornwallis in South Carolina, but Clinton commanded the expedition. It has a heading, of course, to give him importance. By His Excellency Henry Clinton, Knight of the Most Honorable Order of the Bath, General Commander-in-Chief of all His Majesty's forces within the colonies lying on the Atlantic Ocean from Nova Scotia to West Florida, inclusive. Proclamation. Whereas, notwithstanding the gracious offers which have been made to receive to His Majesty's peace and protection, with pardon and oblivion for their past offenses, all those his deluded and infatuated subjects who should return to their duty and a due obedience to the laws, yet there are some wicked and desperate men who, regardless of the ruin and misery in which the country will be involved, are still endeavoring to support the flame of rebellion, and under the pretense of authority derived from the late usurped legislatures, are attempting by enormous fines, grievous imprisonments, and sanguinary punishments to compel His Majesty's faithful and unwilling subjects to take up arms against His authority and government.
Phew. He didn't hold back, did he?
No, he did not. He did not hold back. And he goes on and talks about the intimidation. And of course, actually, he got that point right, because there was intimidation being used against the Tories, as depending on where they were in the backcountry, they had been doing against the Patriots.
At the time I was working on this book, I really didn't understand where he was getting his information. But I've since then learned that James Simpson was Clinton's key loyalist South Carolinian who had basically been run out of Charleston for being a loyalist, had gone to England, given a lot of opinions about how poorly things were being managed in South Carolina, and was subsequently sent back to Clinton by Lord George Germain.
And Simpson was convinced that the backcountry was loyal. I mean, Clinton, part of the reason for coming here is the idea was that all you got to do is land, and particularly the backcountry will rise up and rally to the king's cause.
They held to that notion from the very beginning, from the campaign in 1776, when Henry Clinton came down and tried to capture Charleston from the sea in conjunction with Commodore Sir Peter Parker.
Yeah. And, of course, you had the great battle at Sullivan's Island, which was a tremendous victory for the Patriot cause. And as we need to remind folks, this happened in June 1776, before the Declaration of Independence. And actually, at Greenwood, up in the backcountry, the first blood of the Revolution in South Carolina was shed in December 1775 in a conflict between Tory and Patriot militia units. So in all the southern colonies, but particularly in South Carolina and Virginia, the pot had been boiling for several years, in fact, in South Carolina since 1770, before it finally blew up.
I tend to believe that the war was almost lost in South Carolina, but was definitely won in South Carolina. Just my partisan view. I could be wrong.
So we've got Clinton issuing this proclamation in May, and he has several others, the most important of which, I think, is the one he issues on June the 3rd. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to read a brief portion of that. By His Excellency Sir Henry Clinton, Knight of the Most Honorable Order of the Bath, General and Commander-in-Chief of all His Majesty's forces within the colonies lying on the Atlantic Ocean, from Nova Scotia to West Florida inclusive, etc., etc., etc. There were three et ceteras. Proclamation. Whereas after the arrival of His Majesty's forces under my command in this province in February last, numbers of persons were made prisoners by the army or voluntarily surrendered themselves as such, and such persons were afterwards dismissed on their respective paroles. And whereas since the surrender of Charlestown and the defeats and dispersion of the rebel forces, it has become necessary that such paroles should be any longer observed, and proper that all persons should take an active part in settling and securing His Majesty's government and delivering the country from that anarchy which for some time past has prevailed. Very clear. You got to be on our side. Hayne is back on his plantation. His wife is ill, and he has young children. So let's talk some more about what Hayne does, you know, right after the fall of Charleston. He's outside, but he just goes home, right?
He goes home, intending just to mind his own business.
Which actually was the way, sadly, a lot of folks felt about the Revolution. But all of that changes once the British get here. All the other outposts, as we mentioned, have surrendered. People like Hayne have gone home. And then what happens?
Piecing together what happens next is a challenge because the sources are all very partisan in nature. You have Alexander Garden's account, you have David Ramsey's account, but the general sense that I got was that Hayne was at home and he was visited by Colonel Robert Ballingall, who was a loyalist officer from that general area. Perhaps before the war they had been neighbors, perhaps they had been friends. But this officer arrives at Hayne Hall, Isaac Hayne's plantation near Jacksonboro, to inform him of the alterations in the terms offered by General Clinton. No longer were paroles going to be in effect. Isaac Hayne was going to have to submit to British protection or not. It's hard to know if Ballingall was there as a friend informing Hayne or if he was there to antagonize him. There's no evidence one way or the other. But Hayne made it clear that he was not going to do anything that would cause him to be required to serve in the British Loyalist Provincial Forces.
That is something, by the way, that the British began to do immediately once they were in Charleston. In fact, James Ferguson was kind of in charge of recruiting Loyalist forces. He ended up with over 1,000, and they met their end at Kings Mountain, but that's another story. They were actively recruited. I think they had a goal of about 3,000 troops that they expected, because Clinton's plan, which Cornwallis had to execute, was he was going to roll up the colonies, but that means he had to leave somebody in control of South Carolina, and it was going to be Loyalist troops, Tory troops.
Well, I think they were fairly successful recruiting in the backcountry, especially around 96.
But they were. And this is one of those questions that people always ask, well, how can you identify a Loyalist? Were they the Lowcountry elite? Were they the Germans in the backcountry? Who was it? What denomination they belonged to? Well, I know you have read the Loyalist transcripts, and it's a cross-section of the population. Mm-hmm. You've got a tavern keeper from some little crossroad in the backcountry. You've got rich Lowcountry planters. You've got some people who are of German extraction. You've got a few, not many, Scots-Irish. So there is no one single clue as to who or why somebody was a Tory.
Well, it was a real dilemma. You had, take for example, your shopkeeper, tavern keeper, tradesman in Charleston. They were stuck there. They had a family to feed. They were either going to be treated oppressively or not. And a lot of these people took British protection out of absolute necessity. And there were some who, after the fact, were very forgiving of those. William Moultrie was one, and in fact, he wrote that he encouraged several of his friends to just go ahead and take protection to preserve themselves.
All right, and let's explain what protection means, taking the king's protection.
Taking the king's protection essentially meant that you signed an oath of allegiance to George III and promised to be a good British subject from then on. And, of course, according to General Clinton's proclamations, that might indeed mean serving in the Loyalist militia.
Okay. And some very prominent South Carolinians, including future partisan leaders like Andrew Pickens, took protection. Mm-hmm. And those civilians who had been captured in Charlestown took protection.
And the ones that didn't found a lot of trouble for themselves when the British suddenly arrested them one morning in August 1780 and shipped 60-some-odd of them to St. Augustine.
Yes, and they shipped what they thought were the principal troublemakers to St. Augustine in hoping to nip the rebellion in the bud, because by August, things were already beginning to unravel for them.
It was really, really an interesting and convoluted time for all of those folks. And it's easy to sit back from a distance and judge those who took British protection harshly. But in many, many cases, there was no choice.
And then you've got cases like William Moultrie, who's the subject of your other biography, they did their best to bribe him to join the British cause.
They tried to bribe him. They tried to bribe his son. And they even threatened William Moultrie through intimidation. They wanted him to join their side and go lead troops in the West Indies.
Getting the leading men to join is, for those who study counterinsurgency, that's one of the things you want to do. And that's one of the reasons the Army of Occupation began to fall apart in South Carolina, because the better men in those small communities chose the patriot side. And clergy were often very important. There wasn't a Presbyterian clergyman in the backcountry who was not anti-English. One of the most notable exceptions was the pastor of the Fair Forest Baptist Church in what's now Spartan District. And he was a Tory. But whether it's James Williams over in 96 or whether it's Bratton, Lacey, the folks in York County, they all chose the patriot side. And what's going on in the backcountry has an influence of what's going on with Hayne in the Lowcountry, right?
It does. And it's interesting that you use the term leading men, because in his neighborhood, in his town, Isaac Hayne was considered one of those leading men. And some of the other erstwhile patriots were watching Hayne to see what he would do. He finally found himself in an untenable situation. He was being required to go to Charleston to sign his allegiance to King George to take protection. At the same time, his family was suffering from the effects of an epidemic of smallpox that was sweeping the area, and his wife and two of his children were very, very sick. He had the idea that if he traveled the 30 miles to Charleston, he could do what he had to do, perhaps get medicine and medical help for his family, and get right back. And when he presented himself to Charleston, the British, for lack of a better word, detained him and said, "Sign here or we're going to put you in jail." And he felt such a need to get home that under duress, he went ahead and took British protection.
All right. Give us a time date for that, roughly.
I think probably June 1780, June, July-ish, late summer.
But still fairly recently after the fall,
yes,
of Charleston.
Yeah.
Chip, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Dr. Chip Bragg about his biography of Isaac Hayne, Martyr of the American Revolution. All right. Hayne goes to Charleston to sign. He was going to sign the protection anyway, right?
That's not clear.
Okay.
It's not clear whether he went there to take protection and did, or whether or not he went seeking help for his family and hoped to get there and leave without really having to do anything.
Okay. But the bottom line is he signed it, and he goes back home.
He did.
And his wife dies.
His wife died, and one of his children died. And one of his other children had been so sick that they had constructed the coffin already.
Okay. So we're talking about late summer, early fall 1780 now. Mm-hmm. So does he just sit there at his plantation?
He does for a good long time, probably for at least 6 months, maybe eight. And during that time, as you know, so much happened in South Carolina. There was the Battle of Camden, the American disaster. Then there was American success at Kings Mountain and Cowpens. In that time frame, the British were gradually giving up South Carolina, and the American army, General Greene, was taking increasing amounts of territory.
Yeah, because Daniel Morgan comes and joins back up with him after the Battle of Cowpens, and then they make the race to the Dan and River in Virginia, and then they turn on Cornwallis, Guilford Courthouse, and Cornwallis has that wonderful expression when he's taken his what's now a pretty much battered army, I won't say defeated, but that's close, to the coast, and he writes a friend and said, who inquired, was he going back to South Carolina, and he said, basically, I've had enough adventures there. and he decided to go off to Yorktown. But Nathaniel Greene brings his army into South Carolina. And one of the things that Greene did that was so different from his two predecessors was he understood how to use effectively the partisan bands. That's where I think we're headed right now with your story.
As the British withdrew closer and closer to Charleston and Greene came down into South Carolina, the partisan bands, the Patriot militias, became increasingly active. And in Haynes' part of the woods, the militia colonel was William Hardin, who was constantly trying to get Hayne back on the American side for two reasons. They considered Hayne one of the prominent men and a good leader, but also several hundred other men were watching Hayne still to see what Hayne was going to do. This brings up one of the controversies of the time, which is whether or not your allegiance that you've signed is valid once the countryside changes hands. The British would emphatically say it does not become invalid. The Americans would say otherwise because that's how they wanted to get former loyalists who were only being loyalists out of convenience to come back over to their side. So about this time, and we're talking maybe February, March, April of 1781, both sides are pressuring Hayne to join their armies. The British were pressuring Hayne to become a loyalist militiaman, and he was resisting. He said he would never fight against his countrymen. And at the same time, the Americans were essentially saying the same thing. There's a very interesting letter written by then South Carolina Governor John Rutledge, essentially saying that Hayne was being told that if he didn't join up with the Patriot side, he would suffer very much the same consequences that the British were offering. So it became pretty clear that he was going to have to go one way or the other. It was just which side he would go to. And since he had always said emphatically that he would never fight for the British against his countrymen, it just stands to reason that as soon as the Americans had good military control of his area, that he would rejoin the Patriot forces. Okay.
And you mentioned William Hardin, name probably people don't remember today, but I'll just remind our listeners, when they come to the capital city, that the streets that run north and south are named for Revolutionary War heroes. And Hardin Street is there. People might wonder who was Hardin. But he was a key figure in the Lowcountry militia.
He was. He did a good job and was successful. He just didn't have the brand recognition of Francis Marion. And he was one of Marion's subordinates in the overall grand scheme of things. But just like Andrew Pickens, he had taken British protection. And then when he couldn't stand it any longer, he went back to work for the Americans.
Yep.
But to give you an idea of how much Hayne wanted to hold on to the terms of his taking protection, when the Americans were trying to coax him back over onto their side, when he heard that they were in the vicinity, he would have his horses taken and hidden in the woods because he was concerned that if the Patriot militia took his horses, that the British would perceive that he was assisting the Patriots. He was very much trying to hold on to playing by the rules within the bounds that he could.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the fact that if his horses were taken, the British would accuse him of being a traitor. It was almost like a Big Brother situation. All it took was a rumor, and you were guilty.
Well, it came out later on that just the conversations that Hayne was having with the Patriot militia, that's considered communication with the enemy. You're not supposed to have communication with the enemy. Hayne's telling them, his friends, no, I'm going to stay out of this if I can. The British use those conversations against him.
Okay. Well, let's bring this story up to when he finally makes a decision.
Okay. Probably around April 1781. The exact date is not clear, but he rejoined the Patriot militia and took quite a number of his friends back on duty with him.
And just to set the stage elsewhere, by the time he comes on board, Guilford Courthouse had taken place several weeks earlier in March, and so Greene is moving back into South Carolina. Before Cornwallis had left South Carolina, he said, you use every means necessary, which meant that they roughed up the local population, which all it did was increase resistance. So is that something that really brought Hain into the fold? Was there some incident like that?
No, I don't believe that there was any one particular incident. I think that he became weary of being under the constant threat of the British. He was starting to be leaned on a little bit by the Patriots, and his path of least resistance was just to rejoin the Patriot side.
All right, so he joins Hardin's band. All right, let's pick up the story there.
About this time, we should probably bring General Andrew Williamson into the picture.
Okay.
Who was a Patriot leader in the backcountry, and after the surrender of Charleston, saw fit to withdraw from active participation against the British. And subsequently, he took protection and wound up on the outskirts of Charleston. Now, it was generally believed that he was assisting, aiding, abetting the British, providing them with knowledge, information, intelligence, provisions. And the Patriots really wanted him back. And so they mounted a lightning raid, so to speak, with Isaac Hain at the head of a fast-moving cavalry column that swooped in the middle of the night and took Andrew Williamson out of his bed and brought him back to the environs of Jacksonboro.
And how did the British react to that?
Incensed.
Okay.
First of all, they had been receiving assistance ostensibly from Williamson. He was their guy, so they hated to lose him. He was a high-ranking officer, and they were very much afraid that he would be spirited away and executed for aiding and abetting the enemy. And they were enraged that a Patriot party had swooped in right under their noses and taken him away. And they reacted by mounting their own cavalry column to go back and get him.
And there are still British outposts, like say 96 at this point, still in British hands, Georgetown. So they weren't hemmed into Charleston.
Not quite yet.
So we've got Williamson in Jacksonboro or near Jacksonboro?
None of the existing documentation states specifically where they took Williamson. But the day or two, the morning or two after the raid, Hain and his compatriots are what they think is safely back home. They've got Williamson there. They're probably in one of the local houses. The main militia army is a short distance away at an area called the Horseshoe. Hain's having breakfast at the home of Mary Ford, her plantation called Woodford, when the unexpected happens.
A British raiding party shows up.
A British raiding party shows up. They attack the Horseshoe first and inflict enough losses on Harding and his men there that Harding can't really mount a pursuit. Somewhere along the ways, the British are informed that Hain and probably Williamson, too, are at this local house. And they raid this house and regain Williamson and capture Hain.
Lieutenant Colonel Balfour is going to play a major role in this, and tell us who Balfour is.
Balfour was a British officer who was in his 30s. He was fairly close in age to Isaac Hain. He was from Scotland. He was from a good family, but a poor family. And he was able to buy his way into the military, as was the custom, and with every rank increase, he became more and more in debt. But he was a good officer. He served at Bunker Hill and in many of the major campaigns and battles of the North. He became aide-de-camp to General William Howe, who commanded the British before General Clinton. And he basically was a good British officer who seemed to really, really despise the colonials. He came south with Clinton's army during the Siege of Charleston. Clinton sent him with Ferguson up to 96 for recruiting. Once Clinton departed South Carolina for New York, Cornwallis sent Balfour to Charleston to be commandant of the town of Charleston.
This is another example of where the British probably weren't very smart. When they had captured Georgia, they reinstituted civilian government. They put a military government in South Carolina, even though the last royal lieutenant governor, William Bull, who was a loyalist but a multi-generational South Carolinian, came back to the captured city. But it's a military government, so a military tribunal. So Balfour has got Isaac Hayne all of a sudden a prisoner in Charleston.
So Isaac Hayne was a prisoner in Charleston, but Balfour was really angry by then. He despised colonials. His sphere of influence had been continually shrinking as the Americans regained South Carolina. He was a pretty harsh guy to begin with and had instituted all kinds of harsh measures on the civilian populace of Charleston. He was greatly despised by William Moultrie and by David Ramsey, but he was looking for someone to make an example of. He wanted to punish an American officer who had switched sides in order to set an example to prevent others from doing likewise.
And Isaac Hayne fell into his lap. He's imprisoned, and so since we have a military government, a court-martial, a tribunal?
That's what one would think. And that's what Isaac Hayne thought. So he's a prisoner in the exchange in Charleston. And he receives word that he is going to have a hearing and that he's entitled to legal representation. He chooses a lawyer, a local patriot friend of his, John Colcock, who incidentally he's not able to locate to apprise of his situation and obtain legal help from. But they have a hearing, and a hearing is sort of a stretch of the term for what Hayne received, but they basically put him in front of a panel of officers just to determine that he actually was Isaac Hayne, who had been captured and was now at the exchange. Isaac Hayne thought that this would be a hearing that would lead to some appropriate form of due process. They had to decide if he was a spy, which he could not have been a spy because he was captured at the head of his troops behind his own lines, or was he a British citizen, in which case he would be entitled to the due process and protection of British citizens, or was he an American combatant, in which case he would be entitled to the rights and privileges of a prisoner of war. So Hayne goes to this hearing thinking that he is going to be determined one of those three, more specifically one of the two, British subject or not British subject. And instead, it's a very short proceedings. They identify him and they put him back in his cell in the exchange.
Then they announce he will be hanged.
They announce that he will be hanged. And of course, he's astonished.
Mm-hmm. The date is set. It's a public hanging.
Mm-hmm.
It's several, how many days between the announcement and the actual execution?
It actually drug on for 4 or 5 days because as soon as he was informed that he was going to be executed, he accepted that that was going to be his fate. He expressed his surprise that the hearing that he attended was not exactly what it was advertised to be. It wasn't really a hearing at all. He never had a chance to call witnesses, of which he stated he could have called many. He didn't have legal representation because they couldn't find his lawyer. It was all a very summary process. But he asked the British authorities, in quotation marks, meaning Balfour, and by that time, Lieutenant Colonel Francis Lord Rawdon of the British Army who was on the scene as well, if he could have some time to say goodbye to his children before he made that, quote, awful change.
Okay. And so his children were brought to Charleston?
Three out of his four children were brought to Charleston. One was visiting far away with a relative and didn't get back. And they were taken by his sister-in-law, who was a widow, and they were brought to him for his goodbyes with them. But she also took them to see Colonel Balfour, whose headquarters was in the Miles Bruton House in Charleston, and they literally got on their hands and knees and begged for mercy.
It's my understanding, and this mostly is coming from Ramsey's accounts, that both Rawdon and Balfour were literally bombarded with petitions, not just from patriots, but I mentioned Lieutenant Governor William Bull, who was a loyalist through and through, who was seriously ill, who had a litter carry him to Balfour's office and pleaded for Haynes' life. So it was not just a one-sided thing. The loyalists in Charleston realized this was going to be a mistake.
I think they did. I think that they realized that no good was going to come out of this.
So let's bring up the fateful day.
Okay. The time has finally come for his execution, and all pleas for mercy and clemency have been denied, and everybody seems to accept that the inevitable is going to happen. So Haynes is led from the exchange, and he is given the choice of riding in a cart with his coffin or walking, and he chose to walk. They headed west from the exchange on Broad Street, and my understanding is that much of the citizenry lined the streets, standing indoors, looking out windows, that it was very quiet except for the wheels of the cart that were carrying his coffin and the hoofbeats of the horses and the tramp, tramp, tramp of the 200 some odd man British guard that was accompanying Haynes to escort him to his place of execution and to keep the peace should it be necessary. And I believe that they turned north on King Street, and the distance was about a mile. And whether or not his hands were tied behind his back or in front is a little controversial. Different sources state different things. But along the way, he was hoping that his request to die the death of a soldier would be honored. He made only two requests to the British. One was granted and one wasn't. The first request that was granted was to be allowed to say goodbyes to his children. The second request was that he be allowed to die the death of a soldier, and that was to be put in front of a firing squad. So as they made their way up King Street to the place of execution, the closer they got, it became increasingly evident to Haynes that he was not going to have his second wish fulfilled, because whether it was an actual structural scaffold or a rope thrown over a tree, we can't say, but he eventually realized that he was going to be hanged. And he said to one of his friends who was allowed to accompany him that he would do his best to face this form of execution with fortitude, and that's what he did.
Okay. Any other last words he had?
In contrast to Nathan Hale, who may or may not have said something memorable at the time, mainly Isaac Haynes said goodbye to his friends, shook their hands, commended his children to their care, and then informed the executioner that he was ready.
So very calm demeanor and literally walked to his fate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Now, the aftermath of the execution of Isaac Haynes.
Very interesting to me, and I hope to our listeners too. Isaac Haynes was a name that over a period of time was known by everybody from the streets of Charleston to the Houses of Parliament. The Patriot and the Loyalist militiamen, both sides, they knew who Isaac Haynes was. the Continental soldiers and the British regular army soldiers. They knew who Isaac Hayne was. General Greene and General Cornwallis knew who Isaac Hayne was, as did General Washington and General Clinton, as did the Continental Congress and the Houses of Parliament. They all knew who Isaac Hayne was before it was all finished.
How did all these people get to know Isaac Hayne?
Well, of course, the people of Charleston witnessed it. Word spread out to the militiamen on both sides. Of course, the British soldiers in town observed it. Their officers observed it. But before his execution, Isaac Hayne assembled copies of the correspondence that had occurred between him and the British authorities. And he put it in the hands of his son to put in the hands of someone else who would transfer it to Greene and eventually to Philadelphia, where the Continental Congress was meeting. So Greene knew about it. He was in South Carolina. The Continental Congress knew about it in Philadelphia. And then that correspondence was published in the Philadelphia newspapers, and copies of the Philadelphia newspapers made it into British hands and were transported across the ocean to London, and that's how the Parliament knew about it.
And there were people in Parliament who were opposed to...
It turned out for Colonel Rawdon, there turned out to be quite a backlash in the House of Lords after a few months. You know, we didn't have 24-hour news cycle back then like we do now, but months later, when Rawdon, who was every bit responsible for Hayne's execution as Balfour, and we could talk for an hour about which one was more responsible. It's hard to pinpoint. I consider them co-equal.
Okay.
But word had already reached the House of Lords about this incident, and when he got there, he found that there had been a resolution in the House of Lords censuring him for his actions in Charleston, and this resolution failed. But Rawdon was quite angry with the members of the House of Lords that had instigated all of this, and he almost wound up challenging one of them to a duel.
I mean, he basically, there were his fellow peers, mm-hmm. nobility of England, who wanted to censure him for his actions.
And they rightly probably should have waited for him to get there to hear his point of view, which they didn't.
Hayne became something of a rallying cry for the Patriots, just as the Waxhaws had been earlier.
There were a lot of Patriots who were on the fence that were galvanized by what happened to Hayne. And you mentioned Greene. Greene was on the horns of a dilemma about this. He very much would have liked to have retaliated. However, George Washington pointed out to him, retaliation is a really hard thing to do when you don't have the principal actor to retaliate against and instead have to just pick some innocent party to use as your victim. But he did threaten the British with retaliation enough to the point that the British never did it again. The British officers were very anxious about this whole thing because they were worried about falling into American hands and becoming the victim of retribution.
How has history looked at Isaac Hayne?
Not very much. Isaac Hayne was executed right about the time things were starting to roll up and progress towards a happy ending for us. Not for him, obviously. But not very long after his execution, Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown, and things started winding down. And so for that reason, he was pretty much forgotten. If he had been executed early in the war, he might have been a martyr hero of the same stature of Nathan Hale, or perhaps in a different part of the country. One of his great-grandsons pointed out that if Isaac Hayne had been executed earlier in the war or in Boston, that there would have been a monument to him as tall as the Bunker Hill monument. But in fact, in South Carolina at the time, nobody even knew where he was buried.
You certainly have brought him back to life, though, with this wonderful little biography.
Well, thank you.
Anything you would like to add before we sign off today, Chip?
I would like to add that I hope that South Carolinians will be proud of the conduct of their predecessors and how they resisted to the very end and, for the most part, seemed to want to do what was right and virtuous.
All right. Dr. Chip Bragg, author of Martyr of the Revolution, The Execution of Isaac Hayne, South Carolinian, thank you so much for being with us today on The Journal.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. The story of Isaac Hayne is not as famous as that of Nathan Hale, but it's a complicated story, and it became quite a cause célèbre in the last year of the American Revolution on both sides of the Atlantic. An execution, contrary to war, or did a traitor meet his just ends? Chip Bragg examines this case beautifully and comes to the conclusion, I think justifiably so, that his title is right on the money. Martyr of the American Revolution, The Execution of Isaac Hayne. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.